Right now, I'd like to welcome Jerry Sabloff. He is the new president of the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about the Santa Fe Institute, perhaps in the context of Murray Gell-Mann. Mm-hmm. People know that it's there, but a lot of people don't know quite what happens behind its very nice walls.
One of the things I've learned, I started at SFI at the beginning of August, so we've been here about a month. I think people know the SFI name, and they know it's up there on the hill near Hyde Park Road, but you ask someone what happens there, and a few people kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, that's kind of a think tank where these brilliant scientists work. And others will say, you know, I'm not sure, I've heard of it. So,
and some might say complexity.
Yes, someone in the know might well say that. And some of them have said to me, oh, yes, I went to one of the public lectures. But I think clearly it's one of those phenomena that you see often. We're better known, you know, outside of Santa Fe in many ways internationally than we are locally. And certainly one of my tasks, and I think Jeffrey West, my predecessor, started pushing that direction as well, is to try to make ourselves better known in the community, not only through our lectures, but you know, we do a variety of outreach. Ginger Richardson, our vice president, in that area, you know, we have a summer school, we have a program for school kids, the GUTS program, and a host of other activities that we try to bring science to the public. But it's clear from the initial reaction we have a ways to go, and we're certainly going to strive to do better in that regard.
So what actually does happen up there?
Okay. Well, it's a place where a group of resident scientists and a host of visiting scientists. We have a large group, nearly 100 external faculty. We also have a very distinguished science board, and then a number of students who come to visit to literally think about and study a whole host of problems relating to, as you say, broadly to complexity and the emergence of complexity, but literally from subatomic particles to human societies. We tried to look at the range of these. We have a series of workshops, working groups, symposia, colloquia, all along this line. We have a terrific program in the summer where we work with students, in, you know, variety from undergraduates right on through to postdoctoral students. We have a terrific postdoctoral fellows program, the Amidiar Fellows Program. We have anytime 10 to 12 really terrific young scholars who spend often 2 to 3 years with us. And so there's constant number of scientists working on a host of problems where they're unfettered by, you know, anything from teaching responsibilities to others, where they can really devote their time to working on problems, speaking about them, publishing their results. So it's the best of the kind of think tank.
So it's being a professor without the students in some ways.
In some ways. That's true, but even strong, of having a context, a circle of like-minded scientists around you so that you're not isolated. A lot of important work is done by scientists working by themselves, but I think the brilliance of SFI, if you will, is the fact that we get terrific scholars who then have a chance to really interact and talk, and not only in their discipline. I think what happens in universities, even from scholars who have time away from teaching, is they talk to their fellow biologists or their fellow physicists,
right,
or the fellow, and occasionally they'll talk about interdisciplinary studies, but that may be one kind of biologist talking to another kind of biologist, whereas at SFI we really try to have the physicists, you know, working with the economists, working maybe in my case with the archaeologists and others to look at common problems where the scales may differ, where, as I say, you might be looking at quarks, you know, which,
right,
Murray Gell-Mann first discovered decades ago, or to complex cities today, as a number of us are working on.
Well, this is the thing that is so strange, and I think in some ways counterintuitive, that there are principles that govern subatomic particles, clouds, social structures, fish schooling patterns, and leaf growth, which have something in common with each other.
No, I think this is the exciting concept that SFI was founded now 25 years ago by a group of scientists to tackle just that question. It wasn't a given, but they firmly believed that in looking at complexity, and particularly trying to understand how complex organisms on any scale arise, how they function, that there might well be general principles that they could find. And I think initially they wanted to take some of the really important new understandings in physics and see if they could be applied in other scientific areas, in the hard sciences, in the social sciences, and even in the humanities. And that's been the quest, if you will, for 25 years. We've only scratched the surface. I think we made some important inroads and insights into that problem, but it's a complex one. And
well, what are some of those? I mean, can you explain here on the radio, sitting in the baking company, what some of those principles those are that these seemingly disparate disciplines have in common?
Okay. Well, one area that a number of my colleagues at SFI have been working on is scale. That if you're looking at different entities, different groups, that often the same kinds of, as you go from small to large, as things grow, it may be as an organism grows or as groups grow, that in fact they seem to increase in very similar ways.
That was some of Jeff West's work where animal scale phenomena were involved.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, in some ways, for example, if you look in the animal world and you look at increases in scale, there's actually a loss of efficiency. So if you're comparing an ant to an elephant, as it gets larger and larger, you can actually plot a scale of...
where it's less efficient.
Less efficient. Look at cities. And in fact, as Jeff and Luis Betancourt and others show, it's actually the opposite. It's almost the same trajectory, but in the opposite direction.
So a village is less efficient than a city.
And a smaller city is less efficient than a larger city. Now, that may sound counterintuitive to those of us who visited Mexico City or someplace recently, but by and large, it really holds true, and they've been able to plot this out. So that's just one small example where they're dealing in very different realms. But similar principles seem to hold. There are a variety.
If it's similar principles, then why did it come out the exact opposite?
Well, the principle may be the same, but when you change realms,
it flips around.
It flips around. Huh. But you can still plot it in very similar ways. To give you a more recent example, one of our resident scientists, Don Farmer, and his colleagues have been applying some of the agent-based modeling that's been used in a variety of areas, particularly starting in physics, to look at the world economy, to look at the stock market, and finding that similar principles that work in one whole area, like physics, can actually be productively applied in economics. One might argue, perhaps contentiously, that if more people on Wall Street were aware of these kinds of modeling, I'm not going to say that we wouldn't have some of the recent disasters, but we might have more informed views of the future than we currently have now.
One of the differences between something like the stock market and a system of primates or reptiles or whatever is that this whole issue of ethics and regulating based on ethics comes in human systems. So you have financial regulations that are based on, or healthcare is something that we're looking at now, where a whole system will be very much changed by human intervention.
Right. And of course, that's what makes the task much more difficult when dealing with human societies than if you're dealing with particles or small organisms in a petri dish in a lab.
Because they just do what they do based on their properties.
But the hope is, and we'll have to see whether this works or not, is that the incredible power of modern computation, where you can deal now with millions of actors and variables, that it may be possible to actually find patterns and regularities in human behavior that might not have been possible, even 10 or 15 years ago. And that's one of the hopes, that you could model the world economy, even with, all of the uncertainties of the nature of human behavior and emotions. Now, this may turn out to be a pipe dream. But
yeah, because we don't know the conclusion.
Right. But there are enough encouraging small signs to lead us to believe that this is a worthwhile endeavor.
We're talking to Jerry Sabloff. He is the president of the Santa Fe Institute. Now, you are an archaeologist, and some of your areas of expertise include Mayan civilization and pre-industrial cities. That's a term that I hadn't ever actually heard before. What do you mean by pre-industrial cities?
Cities that come from the ancient world prior to the beginning, what we see as modern urban phenomena.
So ancient Rome.
Right.
Athens.
Absolutely.
Ancient Mayan cities.
But even earlier. Cities actually begin more than 5,000 years ago. The first cities arise in what was then Mesopotamia, centered in modern-day Iraq. So about 3000 B.C., we see some of the earliest cities, Uruk and Ur. We see the beginnings of cities in ancient Egypt at that time, in China. And then thereafter, cities emerge, for example, in East Africa, in what's now Mexico and Central America, in the Andes regions of South America. It's a phenomenon that, through time and space, starting about 5,000 years ago, we see growing entities with large, dense populations with significant number of people who are not producing their own food. They're depending on others, on markets and so on, to bring them food. They're specializing in a host of activities. And so cities have been a remarkably successful phenomenon in very different environmental circumstances, in very different places, in different historical situations. And so archaeologists now, because they have much more field work, we know more about these cities, are starting finding that we do find certain patterns in how cities form.
What are some of those patterns?
Well, if you go back, I mean, the brilliant urban historian Lewis Mumford, for example, in The City and History some years ago wrote, and this has been developed in more recent years, if you look at early cities, there's certain kinds of attributes that are part of them. There's a wonderful book by an author named Joel Kotkin called The City and History, which looks at this. For example, people were attracted to towns and villages that grew because, one, they offered security. They were in situations where they were living on, so that there may have been nomadic peoples who were coming were threatening them, or one village attacking another. If you look at all the early cities, most of them have something like a wall or something that protects and provides the people inside. They may be a moat around it or whatever, with security. So that's one of the beginning. And they're often formed at times of conflict and warfare. And so one can argue that in a way, warfare was one of the earlier grounds for the initial growth of cities.
Right.
Secondly, they were a place of opportunity. People came not only to be secure, but where they had economic opportunity. There was work. They could pursue a livelihood, often that took them from the land as primary agriculturalists to working in some kind of specialized type of economy. It also was a place in some way that was sacred. It usually focused early on a great temple, for example, or another religious structure. And that may have changed through time. The temple may have become the Gothic cathedral, and some have argued, Mumford, you know, that became the skyscraper of 20th century cities. But there was some kind of sacred place that held more than secular interests and bound the population together. And one can go on. Then there's usually some kind of monumental architecture or core and so on. But those three core activities have been crucial to cities, and why I think it's relevant today, because you think of a lot of descriptions of cities today. Are they secure? Do they offer opportunity? And do they have some kind of stronger emotional sacred nature?
Right, and some people that's the arts.
Right, exactly. One might say in Santa Fe, I mean, there are several possibilities. We have our historic churches and cathedral, but you also have the Santa Fe Opera on the hill.
Now, when I think of this whole question of pre-industrial cities, I have to say the first thing that comes to mind for me is how do they deal with water, plumbing, and sewage?
It's, in fact, if we look at various case examples, quite ingeniously. Let me give you two examples from my own area of interest in ancient Mexico. The Aztecs, for example, who actually lived on an island in the middle of a lake where Mexico City now resides. The Spanish, when they arrived in the 16th century, actually drained those central lakes. But they lived on this island. The population on the island and then the surrounding shore, there were actually causeways leading from the island, may have been on the upwards of 200,000 or more, 200,000 to 300,000 people living. They actually built a dam across part of the lake to separate this saline salt water from fresh water so they can maintain fresh water. They literally had barges at the end of canals throughout the island where people dumped human waste and refuse. They literally recycled. Those barges were then taken to agricultural fields where they actually were reclaiming the swamps on the edges of the lake, dumping the fertilizer so they could get terrifically rich. There's a wonderful description of one of Cortez's soldiers when the Spanish arrived first in 1519 and are looking at Tenochtitlan. And these are soldiers who'd seen some of the best urban phenomena in the old world. I mean, they'd seen the great court in Spain. They'd seen the cities of Italy and around the Mediterranean. And they were literally blown away. First of all, they recognized this as a great city. But they were also said, wow, look at how well it's organized. It was laid out on a grid plan. There was a central temple subsidiary. There was a central market, and then local neighborhood markets. You had the causeways. You had the agricultural fields, and it worked. They had aqueducts to bring fresh water from the mainland to the island. They had this functioning system for waste and garbage. It was clean, well-regulated. There literally were judges sitting in the marketplaces to regulate the people and so on. So here was a city that had no contact with the old world. It was a Native American city functioning incredibly well, such that to say these sophisticated Spanish, relatively sophisticated, were actually taken aback. They said, this is better than Seville.
Right.
And their quotes.
And they have chocolate.
Right. Indeed. So the other example, you were asking about water, the ancient Maya, which is my own specialty, you look at one of the great Maya cities is Tikal. Now, sitting in a rainforest, say more than 100 inches of rain a year, but in fact the whole Yucatan Peninsula is a limestone shelf. So when it rains, the rain immediately percolates down to a fairly deep water table. So that if you're not next to a river or a stream, actually even though you're in the rainforest, you need to worry about catching and storing water, particularly because you have at least a three-month dry season from kind of late January to end of April or early May, and sometimes even later, and you need to have enough water to get you through that for drinking, but also for construction. You need water for plaster and so on. So they actually work by a group of scholars shown. They had reservoirs, but they also built their causeways, so they acted as catchment. They catch the rainwater, drain it off into the reservoirs. This was important to maintain the city, but it was also a source of power for the rulers who controlled that water and the access to it. In the site that I worked on most recently in northern Yucatan, a site called Sayil, which is just south of the modern city of Mérida, which is the capital of Yucatan, they literally, again, had no standing water. The water table is something more than 70, 80 meters deep. So with stone tools, which is what they had then, you couldn't reach. You need modern drilling. Equipment to get to it. So what did they do in an area without? They actually, each house had a plastered surface, and they built literally a cistern, and they would collect the rainwater. They'd hollow out the cistern in the limestone, plaster it to make it watertight, and they could collect enough water during the rainy season to have anywhere from 50 people live off that water. And this was a great area with wonderful soils, but unless you could control water, you couldn't. And these kinds of examples around the world are legion. So peoples in these early cities really were quite ingenious in the ways they made these cities function, with substantial populations, not the mega millions of today. But to give you another example, Teotihuacan, which is a great city just outside of modern-day Mexico City.
With those incredible pyramids.
With the pyramid of the sun, pyramid of the moon, that great street of the dead. Again, a grid system. Say at about 300 A.D., it had a population, we don't know exactly, but I think good estimates, 150,000, maybe 200,000 people. If you look in the world at that point, Paris was a bunch of shacks on the Seine. London, a few buildings at best on the Thames. Rome, unfortunately, had gone under, or at least was in the process of rapid decline. Probably the largest city in the world is Constantinople, what's now Istanbul in Turkey. China had a few significant cities. But Teotihuacan, there in central Mexico, with stone tools, no beasts of burden, because they didn't have horses, cattle, oxen, or anything, still.
So we were the beasts of burden.
Yes, it was human labor. Yeah. That city was one of the probably the three or four largest cities in the world. I think there are things that we can learn about past cities, and also what caused them to succeed, and also what caused them to fail that are relevant.
And if we had any sense, we might use that information wisely.
Now, one hopes. Last year I wrote a book aimed at kind of a freshman audience, but was trying to argue for the relevance of different kinds of archaeological research. And the book's called Archaeology Matters. And I was trying to say that the image of kind of archaeologists is this kind of esoteric bunch of scholars off dust covered digging and so on, totally unrelated to the real world, is just not true. There are a lot of things in a lot of areas where archaeology, again, and this is in the SFI tradition of trying to look at complexity, how it emerges, how it develops through time, is applicable not only in the modern world but in the archaic ancient world. And if we can start look at some of the trends, it might well. I'm not going to say that archaeologists are going to save the world or solve modern important policy questions, but they might shed some light and provide some context of why this worked and this didn't. And say part of it saying, well, you know, if in cities, if we don't have security, if we don't have economic opportunity, if we don't have a feeling of this is a special place, we just may be laying, you know, the groundwork for the failure of cities.
We're talking to Jerry Sabloff. He is the brand new president of the Santa Fe Institute. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's my pleasure.